Welcome to Just Ask, the podcast of the Hive Collective, a digital health platform built to empower women to make educated and informed decisions about their health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Heather Quayle, a leading women's and gender-related nurse practitioner. We provide answers to the questions you may not know how to ask by interviewing experts in nursing, medicine, sexual health, and wellness. We started in 2020 with myself and colleague Dr. Tara Thompson, pharmacist, and now welcome our co-host and leading women's health expert and nurse practitioner, Jackie Piasta. This is a safe space where no question is off limits, and we advocate and encourage listeners to just ask their most intimate questions and to break down the barriers of embarrassment and taboo.
I'm Jackie Piasta, your other co-host and fellow Queen Bee of the Hive. Each month, we bring on a new guest that is an expert and healthcare innovator in their respective field. As the healthcare landscape rapidly evolves, we are excited to be on the cutting edge and have decided to evolve the podcast into the Hive Collective, a space that seeks to equip you to better navigate your health journey. To learn more about our new and exciting platform, check out our mission, vision, values, and initiatives as we discuss our rebrand in Season 4, Episode 1. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're excited you're here and hope you enjoy our show.
Welcome. It's great to see you all again. Thank you so much. I have my amazing friend, my colleague, someone I admire so much, Dr. Andrea Braden, today on our podcast. I just cannot wait for you all to hear from her. She is an awesome advocate for all things LGBTQ, marginalized communities, everything you can think of. She encompasses that piece. So without further ado, I am going to read her bio and we're going to jump in because I have so many questions to ask her, as I know Tara does as well. So Dr. Braden, she was formerly Dr. Joyner, graduated from the University of South Alabama School of Medicine in 2007 and completed residency training in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Connecticut in 2011. Since graduating, she practiced as an academic specialist in general obstetrics and gynecology. Her career focus has centered around the postpartum period with a particular emphasis in breastfeeding medicine, perinatal mood disorders, transgender healthcare, and female sexual dysfunction. Additionally, she's board certified lactation consultant, a member of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, breastfeeding expert work group, and a graduate of the inaugural Women's Wellness Through Equality and Leadership, the WELL program, for which she was selected as a representative of ACOG. Dr. Braden has been the recipient of multiple research grants from Emory Georgia Tech's Culture Translational Fund and the Georgia Research Alliance to support her work in improved breast pump technology. She also got a grant with me in ISHWISH, which I needed to add to that bio. And she currently serves as a co-investigator with researchers from Grady Trauma Project on a 2 NIH-funded study that seeks to understand the ties between trauma exposure and pregnancy outcomes in African-American patients who receive care at Grady Memorial Hospital. Furthermore, Dr. Braden is one of the founding physicians for the Grady Memorial Hospital's Gender Clinic, a multidisciplinary clinic that addresses the specific healthcare needs of the trans population. In 2009, she was named one of the American Medical Association's Inspiration Award honoree in recognition of her time, wisdom, and support throughout the professional careers of fellow physicians, residents, and students. When she's not working, she can be found loving on her three adorable children, devouring a good book, playing piano while singing her heart out, volunteering at her children's school, planning trips to warm exotic places, and baking yummy treats at home. She's amazing. She does have the most gorgeous voice, and I could just go on and on and on because I just love you. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Heather. I love you back. And I'm just so excited to be on your podcast today. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. So I need to jump right in because there's so many questions I want to ask.
Okay, let's do it.
So let's kind of go back. Our listeners are people that are lay people. We get some medical people. And actually, our biggest listeners are in Sri Lanka.
Really?
Yeah.
Hello, so, Sri Lanka.
So since we're going to dive right into just LGBTQ care and trans, let's kind of give a little bit of a description around just sexual identity and gender identity. Let's kind of divide what that looks like to start, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Sure. Well, I mean, they're often confused, as you know. So really important to be able to talk about this is to first understand what the terms mean. Sexual identity is distinct and different from gender identity. So let me start with gender identity. Gender identity is something that comes from the individual, and it comes from inside their head. So it's the way you feel about your gender. And it is, you know, it can or may not be aligned with your sexual identity or even your gender expression. So your identity is how you feel as a person in your head and in your heart. So it doesn't really matter what your body looks like or how you dress, or what kind of relationships that you might be in. Your gender identity is a very personal thing about how you feel about your femininity, masculinity, or somewhere in between, or neither. And so sexual identity is different in that it is how you are sexually attracted to another human. And so that can range from, you know, being the gender normative, the gender binary that we often think of is a male is sexually attracted to a female. And we're talking cisgender, which is kind of the what's inside your head and in your heart matches what your body looks like, what you were born with. But sexual identity by itself is really just kind of who you want to have sex with. Now, I work in a gender clinic. And so when we're really trying to be inclusive about this, you have to understand that your sexual attraction may have nothing to do with the sexual organs of another person. You may find yourself sexually attracted to how somebody looks and then find that their organs underneath their clothes do not match their gender expression. So for example, I consider myself a cisgender woman. So in my head, I feel like my body matches how I feel about my femininity. And I tell, you know, my current partner that I am attracted to him, you know, because I like how he looks and, you know, I find myself sexually attracted to him. However, if we were to get intimate and, you know, the clothes came off and he had something underneath that did not match how he dressed on the outside. So say the organs that he was born with fell in the female category as we traditionally understand it. I don't think that would actually change my sexual attraction for him. So you see how that could be different. So yes. Sexual attraction is really, you know, I kind of, you know,
I always say it's who you love kind of thing or what you, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, I probably figure out a way to work it out if, you know, the pieces didn't exactly align underneath the clothes, if that makes sense.
Right.
Does that help?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So then also talk a little bit about what does non-binary mean? Because we hear those too. And so where does that fit in there?
Right. So non-binary is typically referring to gender. Okay. So not physical. It's kind of how you feel. You identify in your head, in your heart. And, you know, it doesn't relate to how your body looks. So non-binary typically means that you don't really feel that your gender identity fits into male or female. It's not all one or the other. And we think of gender along a spectrum. And so non-binary would really be somewhere kind of in the middle, kind of fluid. We also hear it referred to as gender fluid. So perhaps your gender, you feel somewhat both. Maybe you feel both masculine and feminine, or maybe you feel neither, that it doesn't really match up with how you feel as a person. And those words really just don't encompass your personal experience of gender.
So does that kind of fall along? Sometimes we'll hear the pronouns they, them. I know there's other ones that are out there too, but does that kind of encompass some of that gender non-binary?
Absolutely. And what I'm finding now, I learned this yesterday in my gender clinic, you know, the vocabulary keeps expanding.
Yes,
and we
it does.
Keep keeping up with that. But you know, he, she, they pronouns are still not completely inclusive. And there are plenty of people who, you know, are very happy to identify or to use pronouns that maybe she and they, or
yeah,
he
I'm
and they.
A lot more of that. He, they.
Yeah. He, they. Exactly.
And I've had to kind of ask questions just so that I'm more knowledgeable and more aligned ally-wise.
Yeah.
You speak about the trans clinic you founded. I want to hear all about it. I want you to kind of tell us how this kind of came into fruition. And then I want to dive in a little bit more. So when did it start? How did it come about? How did it gestate or birth, as we like to call it in our world?
My involvement was quite by accident, as are many of my ventures in life. But the clinic actually opened, I believe it was 2017, or maybe that was when we started meeting together. I think we opened in 2017. So we've been around 3 years, going on four. I started working at Emory in 2015, and I was approached by Dr. Jason Schneider and Dr. Sonia Ha, both Emory clinicians, Emory docs, one in medicine and one in endocrinology. And this was kind of their baby. They had gotten grant funding to open a gender clinic. And the idea was to have a multidisciplinary clinic where patients could come in. And already these are patients who are kind of marginalized in our healthcare community. So they have a really difficult time accessing basic healthcare, like pap smears, for example, which is where I come in. And they said, listen, we want a patient to be able to come in, be, you know, completely comfortable. Everybody knows their pronouns and the names and how they identify with their gender. So they don't have to go through that barrier of going through the front door and being misgendered all the way just to get basic healthcare. But we would really like to offer pap smears, because that is,
you don't want to do them and you're a gynecologist.
Exactly. Well, and there's exactly. And they can, you know, I mean, there are plenty of medicine docs who definitely can, but you know, they were trying to be conscious of the fact that many of our trans patients who are coming to the clinic might, prefer a trauma-informed approach. Absolutely. Because there's a very high risk of trauma exposure. And that's something that, you know, we do a little more of in gynecology. It's not just the run-of-the-mill pap smear. And so they wanted somebody who was a specialist who could be very sensitive to those issues. And plus, also, you know, they didn't know much about how hormones might affect the exam, some really basic things. So anyway, they roped me in. I had an interest in LGBT healthcare, more by, you know, familial, you know, interest. My little sister identifies as bi, and, you know, I started the Gay Straight Alliance in medical school just to kind of be supportive and learn more about her experiences. And so when they asked me, I was like, sure, why not? You know, I didn't know anything. I have learned a ton, and I now direct the gynecologic services in the gender center at Grady. So it's great. We have a clinic once a month where I go and do it's usually just kind of basic gynecologic healthcare, typically for trans men who have not had bottom surgery. Although I do do preoperative counseling and surgery planning for gender affirming surgeries. And I do some post-op care for trans women too, who've had bottom surgery.
That's one of the questions I was going to ask for our listeners who are hearing these terms maybe for the first time. What is bottom surgery? Does everybody get it? Do you have to? Does it make you any different? What's with that?
Sure. So the term gender affirming is really just kind of talking about things that trans patients do or non-binary patients do to kind of feel comfortable in their own bodies and to basically treat gender dysphoria. So gender dysphoria is the experience, the really disturbing experience of feeling not aligned with your gender and what you've been assigned at birth. Okay, so the whole goal of this gender center is really to treat gender dysphoria. And there are many different ways to do that. The most common thing is really hormone therapy. So you might think of estrogen and testosterone to kind of help feel more feminine or masculine if you're transitioning to another gender. And then there are surgical options as well. And the short answer is no, you don't have to do any treatment at all. There are plenty of trans people who do not have gender dysphoria, and they may feel just fine doing gender expression, just dressing a certain way to, you know, feel comfortable and how they express themselves in the world. But certainly there's no rule or regulation around how you transition to a different gender. So we often have people on hormones. Bottom surgery and top surgery are terms that are used more for, top surgery is for trans masculine patients. So born in a female body, assigned female at birth, basically. And to fight that gender dysphoria, they may request to have the developed breast tissue removed to have a more masculine appearance on the top. So that's top surgery. bottom surgery can encompass a lot of different things and it's quite extensive. So I would say a lot of people do not get bottom surgery. The really basic, I guess easy for a gynecologist one is a hysterectomy, an oophorectomy, which is taking out the internal organs of a transmasculine patient's, and it makes dosing of hormones a little easier, but there are also external surgeries that you can do on the bottom. So bottom just being like, as I say, below the equator, below the belly button, kind of treating the outside and, you know, trying to change the appearance of the external genitalia to treat gender dysphoria.
And there's orchiectomy.
Yeah.
For males as well.
Exactly. So, you know, they can range from really extensive procedures. There's phalloplasty for like trans masculine patients who would like to, so phallo means penis. So, you know, it's creating a penis out of the tissue that was there originally on the vulva of somebody who was assigned female at birth. So they can get very technical.
Yes.
And involved. So a lot of patients, you know, don't.
Do you actually have percentages on people that do the surgeries? I mean, I didn't mean to throw that curveball, but I know people sometimes that are thinking about it want to know what everyone else in the world is doing or what it looks like.
Yeah. You know, as with pretty much all data on the trans population, a lot of it is lacking. Because, you know, they're so marginalized that it's been really hard to get real numbers and population information about the trans population, non-binary population, non-binary, even more marginalized because they're not included in the little check boxes on the demographics of research. So no, I don't have numbers. I only have kind of clinical experience. It is kind of an emerging field.
What you see at Emory, how many of your patients, is it half? Is it less than half? Just on your clinical experience, just to kind of throw something out.
Yeah. There. I mean, for my trans masculine population, so assigned female at birth, I mean, it's definitely a minority who are getting any surgeries. I would say I may be asked, I feel like it's more frequent now, but maybe like 20% who inquire about a hysterectomy, BSO, you know, just the internal surgeries.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't mean to throw you on the spot, but I'm curious.
Yeah. That's just my personal clinical experience. That is not a big number.
So for our listeners, and they're probably like, gosh, why don't we have something like this where we live? I mean, it's amazing the work that Emory's doing around this, but what kind of clinics should they be looking for and how can even our healthcare providers be allies? Like how should they align their clinics if they want to take care of people like this? How do we be good allies?
Yeah. I mean, I think as with a lot of, you know, it's almost like with the breastfeeding allies, they put these little stickers on the windows, you know, so when people come there, you know, you recognize the icon. So we were really intentional about doing these subtle things in our clinic. You know, we put the trans flag, which is this light blue striped flag. And so that's one way. Another way is, you know, the bathrooms are a really big deal. Trans people have a really difficult time deciding which bathroom to go to when the bathrooms are gendered. And so we were really intentional about making our bathrooms gender neutral, any gender, all genders included here. That's a huge, huge one. There are definitely, and I can't remember the name of it, but there are websites where you can sign up as a, you know, trans friendly healthcare provider so that the community, it's very grassroots, efforts right now. Hopefully it will get better, but you know, it's kind of within the community. There are a lot of, you know, community members and support groups out there that collect names of providers. So if you're a provider and you want to be on these lists and have people come to you, then you kind of have to do a little more of the work on the front end to get your name out there.
I've learned from my colleagues. I've learned with my website, put it on your websites, tell them you're trauma informed, tell them you're LGBTQ friendly, trans friendly, just kind of putting it out there. They look for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Social media. Yeah.
I love when I go to a website and you can, there's just the, it says it obviously, but there's also maybe like a little rainbow in the logo or something that kind of says like, okay, I can be comfortable here. Like I'm not going to be, you know, turned away or looked at differently. So
Exactly. So obviously this podcast, diving into another direction, because that's what I always do. Our podcast is really geared around sexual health. So I always have to bring that right back to the table. all the good stuff at the beginning. But what does this look like for someone that aligns as transgender? Is sex going to be different for them? Is pleasure going to be different? Let's kind of dive in a little bit about this in that really taboo topic that really they can hear on a podcast and maybe feel comfortable, and then maybe how to bring it up to their providers.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this one is really a desert in the research area. We don't know much, but we do know humans, right? And if we just kind of look at human beings as sexual beings, you know, it does simplify it a little bit. Yes, there are technical things that can happen when a trans person or a non-binary person goes through gender affirming therapy, right? You have hormones that may change your experience of pleasure. So perhaps before transition, you may have experienced an orgasm in one way, whereas the hormones may change your ability, or the surgery may, you know, affect the nerve endings and change your ability to have sexual pleasure in the way that you once understood it. So what we find in this community is that it's a rebirth, much like maybe a rebirth in a postpartum body. You know, it's not all that foreign if you think about it. There, people have weight gain or health problems, cancers. It's a very common human experience to kind of have a change in your body that changes your sexual pleasure. And so we try to scale it back really and just think, you know, for the individual, what is pleasure for you? How do you experience pleasure? And, you know, of course, a lot of it is, you know, in the head, it's in your brain, and it's that safety piece with your partner. So it's feeling comfortable in your own body and also feeling comfortable expressing yourself with whoever you decide to have intimacy, physical intimacy with. So it's all these different pieces. And I think we don't know much. There's not a lot of research yet on the ins and outs of how the hormones and how the surgeries affect sexual pleasure in the trans population. But that being said, we're all human and we all have similar experiences. So I think treatment of these, you know, concerns probably is multifaceted, probably stuff that you see that, you know, you kind of get to the meat of what's safe and what's pleasurable and how do I feel with a partner, and how do I approach these conversations with a partner, more than one partner, about what I like in my body. And some of it's self-exploration, right? You kind of have to relearn your body.
I want to say that.
Yeah. But you're definitely the expert in that one. So
yeah. Learning your body, learning all those different things for sure. Yeah.
So I have a question because I'm a pharmacist. So everything is like, for me, I'm thinking drugs all right. the time, like what's going on inside. So you said that we know estrogen is one of the main hormones that women have in their body or is needed to develop breast tissue or that type of thing. And then on the flip side of that, it's almost opposite. In men, it's testosterone has the largest.
Correct.
Concentration, I guess you would say. So when a patient comes to you and they're asking for hormones, is that the first thing, or is that the first thing they ask for? Is that the first thing you think about? Or is that more of just an option? Like if you want to start to, or how do you go about that conversation about hormones?
It's really kind of goal setting, individual goal setting. So if they're coming for care in a trans clinic, typically it's for gender dysphoria. They have been struggling and, you know, there's a lot of debate. I will go on a little tangent here about, you know, the reproductive consequences. There can be some permanent consequences to some long-term hormone therapy. But you know, in the trans population, the suicide risk is like 40%. And so this simple hormone treatment can actually be life-saving for many of our patients. And yes, it is usually the first thing that they want. Some people I'm sure would do great just with counseling, and don't want the hormones, or maybe they go on hormones and they come off. The hormones are definitely going to give you more of the physical appearance of the desired gender. And so it does help with gender expression, which in turn helps with the dysphoria. So I would say a majority of our patients are on either testosterone or estrogen. to get the, you know, testosterone will give trans women this, or trans men, the side effect of male pattern hair growth. It will give you clitoromegaly, or growth of the clitoris, which can increase pleasure and also give kind of, you know, a phallic appearance to the external genitalia. So you get different hair growth, hair distribution, vocal changes on testosterone. Estrogen on the other side is definitely going to develop that breast tissue in a trans woman. And so that's one of the biggest desires for gender dysphoria, is to have that developed breast tissue. And, you know, lots of questions about cup sizes and, you know, what's it going to be, but it's just like going through puberty for cisgender women. Nobody knows.
Yes. My trans female at my little trafficking center, she is adorable and she's starting to develop, and
It's so exciting. I remember those days.
Super excited about breast pain.
Yep.
It's always like, Dr. Heather, what is this normal? Is this what it's supposed to feel like? And like us that have been born as females, we're like, oh, the breast pain. Oh, this. And so she's embracing this, which has been.
I was like her. All I wanted were boobs. I couldn't wait. I was like,
now I'm like, I would like to be little A cups.
Well, I think this is really how I ended up in breastfeeding, as a breastfeeding or lactation specialist. I've been obsessed with boobs my whole life. So I get it. It's very exciting.
So I know all the work you're doing in the breast pump world, but please let our listeners know, especially the work in the breast pump and for trans and for people that actually want to be able to feed. Like, I'm just so empowered by this.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the trans community, every time I talk about it, is kind of like mind blown. Like, they're just trying to get to hormone therapy. They're like, what?
Yes.
Breastfeeding? And so this kind of, oh, my crazy ADD interests. Where did this one begin? I was teaching a lecture to med students and I told them, I'm like, did you know that you can induce lactation in a trans woman? So somebody who is assigned male at birth, who has gone through hormone therapy, has mature breast tissue once they're, you know, they've gotten to that stage that you and I were talking about through puberty, you can stimulate milk production in a trans woman. And so my med student was like, holy Toledo, this is amazing. Let's research this. So we have since published a paper on the need for this. And it was an international study we did at the WPATH conference a few years ago, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. There is definitely a need. There are definitely trans women who are ready, you know, to build their families, and who, I mean, what a validating experience to be able to lactate as a trans woman. So the breast pump was also kind of an accidental interest. I was pumping for my own third child and really irritated about how it was everybody's business how and when I made my milk for my child. And I had decided it really needs to be Nunya, which is what everybody in the breast pump industry is trying to do. Like, it has got to be hidden. It's got to be discreet. It's got to be quiet. So it kind of started that way. I'm going about it a different way.
It has to be hidden and discreet. I mean, if you lived in Europe, you could just pull out your breast pumps and you'd be
right. Right. And it's not like we're going to get, you know, maternity leave, which would solve all the problems. But anyway, I won't get on that soapbox.
I won't get on that one.
So we are trying to do a workaround here. But we are intentionally trying to be inclusive, because typically the breastfeeding industry has been targeting a certain type of population, really people who have access to care already, who are able to establish breastfeeding and lactation and chest feeding. And so the discretion is really important, I think, for the trans population. So things that people don't think about are trans masculine patients who have not had top surgery. So they still kept their natal chest tissue, they call it chest in a trans masculine patient, with the intention of wanting to feed their babies. So they may not have had any surgeries, they can still bear children. So this is kind of the Time magazine, the pregnant man, that type of thing. They can still chest feed, but you all the clothing, all the nursing supplies, everything is geared towards cisgender women. And so they may not feel comfortable in those clothes, and they may not feel comfortable feeding their babies in the gender expression and gender identity that they are projecting to the world. And that dysphoria on top of the extra hormones to make that milk can be really, really jarring. Mm-hmm. And so my breast pump, my discreet breast pump, it's called Libby. We have not launched yet, but hopefully maybe by June we'll be out there. We're just kind of getting the social media off the ground.
How'd you get the name Libby?
You know,
it's probably a whole story with that.
It is, you know, the idea of liberating, I kept saying, I want to take flight. I want to, you know, I want to break that glass ceiling. I want this to be something that anybody can achieve. Anybody who wants to lactate, no matter your gender, no matter your race, there are just a million barriers in the way. And if we can really do a good job at hiding this, it liberates the parents to feed their children how they know they need to do that. And it just takes away some huge social stressors that can really get in the way in the workplace. You know, the idea of my pump and my device is that it is long-term wearable. So you can, you know, you're not a slave to the milk management. You can finish what you're doing at, for me, surgery or teaching or podcast. I don't have to immediately jump up and store the milk and put on, take off, you know, remove clothes, which can be especially traumatizing for a trans patient who's having to do this in the workplace too. So really trying to be intentional about reaching more people and giving more people access. We know from the CDC data that 84% of, and now they said women, so a lot of people got left out of the survey, but 84% of women initiate breastfeeding. But if you look at the guidelines, the international and, you know, US guidelines on breastfeeding, we recommend 6 months exclusive. And it's only like 25% of people who actually make it to that guideline. And so there's a huge drop off. There are a million different reasons why, and I'm just trying to, you know, tackle one piece of the pie here and really raise up those numbers and help diagnose problems before they start.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You're always doing new phenomenal things.
Thank you.
The last little bit I want to kind of touch on is just how does actual intimacy look for trans? Like, we've talked about just the gender dysphorias. I want to kind of dive into a little bit. You talked about self-exploration. So of course there's getting to know your body, looking at your body, loving your own body, masturbation things, but where does this fall along with just partnered and trying new things, especially for people that have this gender dysphoria?
Yeah. Well, gender dysphoria, much like a lot of psychological diagnoses, can really be a huge barrier. So much like anxiety or depression, PTSD, you know, it is very difficult to overcome that sometimes. So I would say you can try to muscle through it, but sometimes if you muscle through it, it can be more traumatizing. And then there's that vicious cycle, right? You have more pain, you know, pain, trauma cycle, you know, so it's really kind of scaling it back, addressing the first need, which is a need to love yourself. And, huge. And then once you get through, you know, the self-love that we, you know, that we teach all of our patients and clients, you know, then it's feeling safe with a partner and choosing to be partnered or choosing sexual experiences with people that you feel comfortable expressing your needs. Now the needs may, you know, because there's so much taboo with what's under your clothes and how you present, there's certainly a lot of fear in the trans population that they will be rejected. If they, you know, if they're passing means you look just like the gender, you know, that you want to portray. So, you know, if my gender expression was masculine and I went out in public and nobody questioned me going in a bathroom that was labeled for men, then that would be passing. But what happens when you meet somebody on a dating app or something and you start to get intimate? You have to have that conversation beforehand. I have heard some horrible, horrible stories of people getting intimate and not disclosing this information to a potential sexual partner and, you know, triggering whoever, you know, this partner's own fears, homophobia or whatnot, and ending up in some really dangerous, violent situations. And so for the safety of the patients, it really is important to know where to find partners. There are certainly dating apps that are geared towards this, where you can just kind of put yourself out there exactly as you are before you even meet a potential partner. And yeah. I would recommend finding those safe venues, you know, to meet sexual partners so that you don't, you know, it just takes that load off of you. You don't have to worry about your personal safety.
Have your trans folks told you which are some of the safer dating apps for them specifically? Like, I know which ones there are for us cis heteronormative, and I know a couple for men that have sex with men type of community. Yeah. What about specifically for trans? That just
I do. Oh man, somebody just told me this, and I can't remember the name. Maybe you can put it in your show notes or That's something. We'll look it up. I don't.
You can look it up.
Just told me about this
in our Facebook because. I just like to know what's out there.
Yeah, there are definitely dating apps where, you know, this is, you know, embraced and welcomed. And I would definitely recommend, or if you're not wanting to go on those apps, putting the, you know, your truth out there, being your authentic self. I mean, it's the internet. Who cares what people think, you know, about you? You don't have to meet anybody. It's kind of making those boundaries around yourself and your body safety. And you know, there are definitely people who are predators out there. So it's kind of going about it in a safe way and feeling comfortable with who you partner with.
Actually, Tara just gave me a couple that she posted. I guess there's Lex, Fiori, Tinder, Scruff, OkCupid, hashtag open, and Taomi. I don't know if I just said that right. Have you heard any of those from your trans folks?
I mean, definitely Tinder.
Yeah, Tinder I'm familiar with.
I mean, Grindr is another one, yes. Which might be, yeah.
More geared towards gay.
Men have sex with men. I don't remember the names. I know I have personally been on OkCupid, and I will say people are very open in that venue. I had lots of people just put it right out there and be like, hey, I'm into this. Are you into this? And so.
Yeah, I've heard OkCupid for fetishes and kinks and things in my training for sure.
Yeah. And so I feel like that venue may be okay, but perhaps some of these other ones that Tara put on here would be more open to the, you know, trans and non-binary community. I know they exist, so we can fact check this later, but I would recommend that. I mean, I've definitely had a trans feminine patient who came to me really concerned. She had had bottom surgery, but when you have a neo-vagina or you have a vagina built out of the penis and testicles, it requires a lot of maintenance. I think that's one reason a lot of people don't go that route, because you have to dilate for the rest of your life to keep the orifice open, to keep that vagina open for use, for penetrative use. And so with this patient, she was totally passing. I don't think anybody off the street would know that she was trans. She had a great surgeon. Everything looked beautiful. She was terrified of partners finding out, you know, her vaginal opening was so small and narrow that she could not have penetrative sex. And so,
I was totally going to bring that up. Like, what does that look like? Can most not have penetrative sex that have had the reassignment?
I think some can. I would say the big barrier that I've seen, and I only see people with complications, is really you don't dilate for a long time after surgery. Maybe you had an infection or something and it closes up. It's, you know, unlike native vaginal tissue, it's created out of tissue that wants to stick together. And so it really requires dilating constantly, weekly, you know, for years and years and years to keep it open, it will close, unlike, you know, a native vagina.
In the menopausal patient. I mean, the opening definitely
gets smaller, definitely. I would say these shorten too, narrow and short. And so it is quite difficult. And so with this particular patient, even though it looked like a normal vulva vagina on the outside, it probably went in 3 centimeters. I mean, it was very shallow, and she did not know how to tell her partners not to use that vagina. She preferred to have anal sex. But how do you approach that?
And
how
do you approach that topic with
you? You know, I mean, there are many questions, and this is a very individualized thing. And I think her main struggle was she was dating cisgender men, and I don't think she felt comfortable or had figured out a way to, you know, explain her history to people. And not that it's anybody's business. You know, if you want to just have sex with somebody, you know, you are welcome to do that. And so I wouldn't ever suggest that she disclose something she's not comfortable with. That being said, we did a lot of counseling on how do you approach that you would prefer anal sex. Well, the fact is she has a shortened vagina. And we don't have to explain. It's not anybody's business unless it is your, you know, forever partner, maybe.
You know what? I was born that way. Just anatomically different, and I'm not comfortable.
Exactly. I mean, it's just like you would tell any other cisgender patient, right?
I tell my sexual assault patients, you never have to disclose your assault again if you don't want to.
Exactly. Exactly. So I said the same thing. I was like, if you prefer anal receptive sex, you just figure out a way to say that. You know, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do, but having that conversation is, you know, so important for your pleasure and enjoyment and, you know, for this experience. It's not all about your partner, which I think a lot of women, cis and trans, are kind of groomed to think it is all about the masculine pleasure, and we are receptacles for this. Yes. And I see that in the trans population.
Well, we can't even talk about, I always talk about things such as outer course, or if I want to explore right. with toys and vibrators and anal sex, how do I bring that up? Because as cis women, it's like you said, we are just this mechanism for males to have pleasure, but that is a whole other topic.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I did learn in my clinic about, you know, how to introduce anal sex, anal receptive sex, to anybody who wants to, which I was not aware of until I worked in this clinic. But, you know, when you do start with toys, and, you know, a glass dildo will likely go in a little easier just to get used to that sensation yeah. versus, you know, some of those bigger silicone type toys. Something narrow and glass is going to slide very smoothly, and you're not going to have
that. Lots of lube.
All the lube. Reapply often. It dries up.
I say any hole that something is penetrating intimacy wise needs lots and lots of lubes. I don't care what hole it's going into.
That's right. Amen, sister.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I could talk to you for hours, as you know, and I learned so much from you every single time we engage. You're so empowering. I think that you've given our listeners some very interesting things to think about, maybe feel more empowered to love themselves and to know that there are people out there that want to be their allies and care about them. So how do our listeners find you if they want to get more information? Or
yeah, well, I have just launched my own little personal social media something or another. I've branded myself the Wholehearted Doctor. So you can find me on Instagram at Wholehearted, WHOLEHEARTED Doctor, DOCTOR. And that's on Facebook and Instagram, also on Twitter at Wholehearted Doctor. And I do have a website, www.wholeheartedoctor.com. I'm going to hopefully put on some content and conversations, and maybe one day have a cool podcast like you. But you can find me there. That's probably the easiest way.
In that too, like she really, I'm enjoying following and kind of.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
you.
You're just very genuine.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate that.
And I think that's kind of what, I mean, yeah, that's just kind of what people want to see. So yes, I could go on and on and on how much I love Dr. Braden. So thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this during Pride Week. We always try to hit something that's very LGBTQ ally, but we haven't done tons in trans, and I'm just so excited about this.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait. Thank you so much. I'm honored to have been the Pride Week speaker for your podcast.
Yes. Can't wait.
Thank you. I second what Heather said. It's been such a pleasure. We needed to talk about this. We haven't addressed this enough. I know we have listeners who are taking things away from this, getting more information. And like what Heather said, just asking, maybe they can have a little bit more confidence or feel a little bit more empowered to ask that question. Or learn something new and know that, I didn't know that was out there about this. So,
or start with us, just ask in our messages. If you're afraid to ask on our Facebook, throw it out there to us and we'll help.
We'll get you the resources that you need. So thank you, Dr. Braden. This is really,
you're so welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you. Bye. Thank you, listeners. And we will see you next month.
Thanks for listening to the Just Ask podcast. And thank you for our amazing panelists today and every day. Feel free to contact us publicly or privately with your questions and thoughts. We do not provide medical advice, but we can point you in the right direction and provide resources. You can learn more about the topics we've discussed in this episode by viewing the show notes for this podcast and following us at Just Ask ATL on Facebook and Instagram. Our podcast is available on all of your favorite platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, Google, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Please make sure you subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. If you found value in this discussion, please share this podcast with friends or leave a rating on iTunes. Thanks again for listening. We can't wait for you to join us for the next show.